people say that I threw my brain away, that I'm illogical and don't have much to say. Some people say that it's foolish to believe in what we cannot say, from what is saved.
Thank you again for joining me here on the Freed Thinker podcast. As always, I'm your host, Tyler Vella, and on today's show, I'm going to be responding to some of the things that I should have said or would have said or wanted to say during my recent discussion with Thomas Smith of the podcast Atheistically Speaking, which I announced in the Facebook group over the past couple weeks. Now, for those of you who don't follow the Facebook group to see these announcements, what is wrong with you? Follow the Facebook group to see the announcements. No, but really, if you want to see these announcements, please follow the Facebook group. I'll give you the link a little bit later on. But really, if you want to hear that discussion, you can look up the podcast Atheistically Speaking in iTunes to get those two episodes, or you can stream it straight from their website. During that discussion, I kind of wandered down some rabbit trails. It wasn't my best performance, I have to admit, although I thought it was a really great discussion with Thomas there. And I didn't really get back around to answering some of his questions, how I would have normally liked to answer it, how I would have typically addressed those types of questions. So I wanted to address some of them here afterwards, and then give Thomas the right of rejoinder later on if he would like to. So, however, before I get to that, I want to make a couple of announcements. The Freed Thinker podcast has recently joined forces with some other podcasts and is now a featured show in the Christus Victor Network, which is awesome. So if you want to follow this show there, you can, and you can find out about some other great shows. And so if you want to do that, head on over to the ChristusVictorNetwork.com. It's ChristusVictorNetwork.com, and check it out. It's a new project, so the website's still being fine-tuned a little bit. Thank you to Owen Pond for diligently working on that, and I'm still working on some of the artwork for my episodes to go up, as well as getting some of the links so that the episodes can stream straight from there without having to link to the Podbean site. So there's going to be a great little co-op of Christian podcasts there if you'd like to join in on that network. Get in on the ground floor. Speaking of getting in on the ground floor, you can also sign up as a sponsor of the Freed Thinker podcast, which I would really appreciate, by going to the Podbean page and signing up for a one-time donation or a monthly donation. I could really use the support. I'm trying to save up a little bit of money for some new equipment so I can really improve the quality of the show, because I do it all for you, my dear sweet listeners. As some of you might hear in the background, my newborn son is crying, and as adorable as my son is, some of the sound equipment will help cancel out some of that background noise. So with that, please, if you feel so inclined, head on over to the Podbean page and become a sponsor of the show. And thank you to the sponsors who have already contributed to the ongoing work of the Freed Thinker. Now with that, on with this episode. So in my discussion with Thomas, the question came up of whether or not the Bible is a literary masterpiece. And we kind of went back and forth, and I showed some different ways that I thought it was, it showed some literary mastery. And it, what apparently it came down to was Thomas thought, well, you can understand, you can identify the literary intent or the literary structure, but that doesn't mean that it's good, right? You can understand the literary strategy, but it doesn't mean that it's a good strategy. The discussion, and he admitted it, but I wanted to hash this out a little bit. The discussion basically came down to a difference of opinion. Now, I never want to say someone's subjective opinion is wrong. It's hard to say someone's opinion about art is wrong or incorrect. But here I want to say he dances really close to that line. And really, I have a couple things to say, but my main recourse is just appeal to authority. I mean, the Bible has been, down through centuries of tradition, been viewed as a literary masterpiece, and it's shaped the Western landscape, the Western literary landscape. And it's viewed by those people who study it intently at a literary level as having some really beautiful, striking literary features that range from chiastic structure, that, you know, has inclusios, all of the different, repetitious cycles that go throughout, thematic development, and so on and so forth. And it's not just them, atheists giving out an olive branch, as he seemed to insinuate. I guess this kind of comes down to, how do you convince someone who thinks that impressionism is not good art because it doesn't look like what the realists do? I'm not sure how you get around that. I mean, historically, everyone has thought that the Bible has been a work of literary mastery. The Bible has been seen as a masterful work of literary genius, which it is, for millennia. And what it appears to come down to is just kind of a repugnation at the content, followed by a repudiation of the form. And I know that he might kind of reject that, but I think that's really what it comes down to when you see that a lot of his objections then went towards the theological from that point. I have a quote here from F.F. Bruce. F.F. Bruce, an eminent New Testament scholar, writes, quote, "The elements of artistic form that all types of literature share include pattern or design, theme or central focus, organic unity, also called unity and variety or theme and variation, coherence, balance, contrast, symmetry, repetition or recurrence, variation, and unified progression. These elements of artistry take one form in narrative, another in poetry, another in proverb, and so forth. But whatever the genre, the sheer abundance of literary technique and artistry that we find in many parts of the Bible make it a literary masterpiece. One of the things that a literary approach to the Bible offers over conventional approaches is that it opens the way for readers to enjoy the aesthetic beauty of the Bible. Literary analysis is capable of showing that the Bible is an interesting book rather than a dull book. The artistic excellence of the Bible is not extraneous to its total effect. It is one of the glories of the Bible." End quote. That from eminent literary scholar of the New Testament, F.F. Bruce. So that's a little bit that I wanted to say on the masterpiece. Another one that came up was the clarity of the message, where Thomas wanted to protest that he might not have understood the overall projection of the Bible, and when I kind of laid it out as really God's history of redemption, God acting in history to redeem a particular people. He said, well, you don't really get that until, you know, three quarters into the book. You have all this Old Testament. And I rightly pointed out, well, part of the problem is even if that's true, which I'm going to actually show here in a second, it's not. And I didn't really draw at this point, which is why I wanted to talk about it. But even if it's true, that's like saying a novel isn't good because you don't find out the climax until the climax. That's not really an objection to the clarity of the message. However, what I should have said and what I should have added is the basic plot line of redemption is found throughout the Bible. I mean, there are whole books and books and books and books and books and books dealing with not only Christ in the Old Testament, but the theme of redemption in the Old Testament. It starts all the way at the Proto-Evangelium, the first announcement of the gospel, back in Genesis 3:15, where there's the announcement that eventually God will crush the skull of the serpent with the promised seed of the woman. Right, so you have this first announcement of the coming Savior who will save his people from the curse of the serpent. You have the covenant promises to Abraham, that Abraham will be a blessing to the nations, that he is a particular people, but that he will not only have land and seed, but that he will bless all nations through his seed. There's the promise to the life of Israel. If they're obedient to the law, then they will live long in the land, and they will forever have a Davidic king. There will always be an heir on the throne of David. There's also the ultimate hope of redemption offered throughout the entire Old Testament law. I don't have time to go into this. There's a book by Vern Poitras called The Shadow of Christ and the Law of Moses that goes through how all of the sacrifices, all of the furnishing of the temple, which I know is one of those boring parts, it's one of those repetitious parts where Thomas wasn't happy. Why did it give exhaustive detail? You know, the curtains for the tabernacle are to be 28 cubits wide and 4 cubits tall. And then, you know, 4 chapters later, it says that they made the curtains 28 cubits long or wide and 4 cubits tall and so on and so forth. Why all this exhausted deep? There is so much Christological significance that it points forward, and all you have to do is read the text to understand it. There are beautiful themes that develop about redemption throughout all of the law of the Old Testament, going forward into the promises of the Redeemer in Daniel, the promises of the prophets, and then the promises of the minor prophets going forward. So you have this theme of redemption going forward, and it actually starts to develop this tension where how can God, who is holy, who needs to deal with the sin of his people, also be a God who is faithful to his promises, who promised to forever redeem his people? Well, the answer is found in Jesus Christ. That is why Jesus is the answer to the promise of the Old Testament. Jesus is a way that God keeps his covenant promise to maintain Israel, but it's also the way that he deals with the sin of Israel and the whole world that gets grafted in. So you have this beautiful tying up of these themes in Christ, but it's not that the themes start in the New Testament or anything like that. So that's a little bit on the clarity of the message. And it's one of those things, again, you don't have to understand every single little jot and tittle, every single historical detail. It's going to take a lifetime or more to study those types of things. But you don't need to know that type of exhaustive detail to understand the basic storyline. I mean, the kids in elementary, you know, young kids in church get the basic storyline. They understand it. It doesn't take, you know, a genius to understand the basic storyline of the Bible. So there's clarity of the message. So I wanted to add that. The rest of the time now, I want to spend answering. He asked me what I thought of Genesis 1, whether I thought it was literal or metaphorical. And I answered basically saying, yes, it's literal and metaphorical. But I didn't, we got kind of distracted and sidetracked talking about, you know, the clarity of the message and all this other kind of stuff. And I didn't get a chance to circle back around. And we wouldn't really have had time to do this. So I want to spend just a minute going over really what my view of Genesis 1 is. Now, for some people, this would be shows and shows and shows and shows and shows and shows and episode after episode dealing with young earth creationism and science and all this kind of stuff. I take a very different approach because I don't think that the early Jews were thinking scientifically. I don't think that they were trying to answer those kinds of questions. And I'll give you a link at the end to kind of help understand that a little bit more. So what's going on in Genesis 1? Well, first, there's a little bit of a framework that happens in Genesis 1 when it says the earth was formless and empty, or formless and void. The Hebrew is tohu vabohu, and it means really that the earth was uninhabitable. There's all kinds of speculations, and people who are in young earth and old earth, they go all crazy, you know, talking about, well, you know, this was it was formless because it was in the sea of fluctuating energy of the quantum back. Nothing like that is going on. If you read tohu vabohu in other sections, basically mean that it was an uninhabitable wasteland, right? It was formless tohu. When we read Deuteronomy 32:10, it says in a desert land he found him, in a barren land and a howling tohu, a howling waste. The idea is that you can't live there. It is a wasteland, and it's empty. It's unpopulated because it's a wasteland. That's the bohu, vabohu. Va is the basically like and tohu and bohu. Bohu means because it's a wasteland, it's empty. So we read in Isaiah 45:18, he did not create it to be bohu, empty. Right? He did not create it to be empty, but he formed it to be inhabited. right? Talking about, the it's not empty and it's formed. It's not formless to be inhabited, right? And I think in that context, he's speaking of the land at that point. We look in Jeremiah 4, 23 to 26, and it describes the land after the exile, right? After Babylon had come and just obliterated the land, had overturned Jerusalem. He says, I looked at the land and it was tohu vabohu. It was formless and empty. It was a wasteland that was uninhabitable. You could no longer live there. It had been so uninhabitable, right? So over and over and over again throughout the Bible, whenever you have these words, tohu and bohu, tohu vabohu, especially when they're together, you have this idea of an uninhabitable wasteland. Right? And this plays into the fact, I mentioned it in the episode, it plays into the fact that the Israelites didn't have a materialistic ontology. They didn't have this idea of something coming into being in the same way that we do. When we think of the solar system coming into being, we think of how the solar system came into being, how it materially came about. For them, being was functional. Right, they had a functional ontology. Something existed because it served a function. So when God takes something that is tohu vabohu, right, when it's completely empty and barren and uninhabitable, what he does to quote unquote create it, when he creates the heavens and the earth, what he does is that he's making something good. He's making it habitable. He's making it, it's not a wasteland, it's a garden, right? He's fashioning it into a place that's good and habitable, right? That's the Hebrew conception. So they're not trying to answer questions about cosmology. That's not what they're trying to do. The author is giving a representation that God is creating a habitable place for his people. Remember, now, I'm right here going to assume that Moses is the primary author of this section of the Pentateuch. I don't have time to defend all of that assumption. Some people are going to freak out. Some people are going to talk about source criticism, all this kind of stuff. We can engage in the comments on that if you want to. But for now, it makes sense to understand where is Moses writing this, right? Moses is writing the Pentateuch, or so the theory goes, when he's in the plains of Moab, right before entering the Promised Land. So he's with the children of Israel. They've wandered through the wilderness for a long time. They're about to enter the Promised Land, and Moses is penning the Pentateuch. So what do you think is on their mind when he gives these to the people? The idea is that, look, if God could populate a desolate wasteland, a land that is tohu vabohu, then surely he could cause this land to be inhabitable for you, right? People already live there. It's not tohu vabohu, right? God doesn't need to take a wasteland to make it inhabitable. You just now need to go and inhabit it, right? If God can do the harder one, he can do the easier one. It is the main idea that's underwriting that. From that point, you go into the days, right? The quote unquote days. I'm not going to spend a ton of time going into what yom means. Yom can mean day. Yom can mean a period of time. Yom can mean all kinds of things. It's interesting that, you know, you have the seventh day, but there's no day and night on the seventh day. So we're really talking about 24-hour days, right? So on and so forth. Waltke and Klein, two different scholars, Meredith Klein and Bruce Waltke, basically take a literary view of this passage, right? They take a literary structure, a framework structure, and they say days 1, 2, 3 are, Klein calls them creation kingdoms, Waltke calls them static spheres. God sets up these areas, these environments, and then he populates those environments, right? Because remember, the area is formless and void, so he forms it and then he fills the void. He forms it and then he populates it, right? So you have day 1 is light. Day 2 is the sky and the waters above. Day 3 is dry land. So you have the different spheres. You have light being created. You have the sky, and then you have dry land. And then he fills those. He populates those with what Klein calls creature kings, right? Creature kings in their creation kingdoms, or what Waltke calls sphere populations, right? Population of those static spheres. So for sphere 1, which was light, you have day 4. which is he fills with the luminaries, right? That's when the sun and the moon are created. You have day four. That's when the fish and the fowl, right? You have the waters above and the waters below that are created on day two. He populates those with fish and fowl, right? Things in the waters below and things in the waters in the sky above, right? And on day three, which was dry land, he populates on day six with animals and man, right? So you have the dry land animals and so forth. So you have God going through and creating the formless. Right, or fixing the formless to have form, and then ending the void by populating the void, right? And so you have this framework: day one matches day four, day two matches day five, day three matches day six, right? So that's kind of what's happening in the literary structure. So it's not poetic; it's literary, but it's telling us something true about reality, about the way that the Hebrews viewed the way that God created the world. Because remember, for them, creation isn't a material thing; it's a functional thing. So this is why it's not necessarily literal or figurative, because they're asking the question about function, not of ontology. Another key thing in this passage is the use of a Hebrew word eretz. Eretz is the Hebrew word for land. It can mean earth, it can mean land, it can literally mean like the land that you're standing on, the dirt, the ground that you're standing on. And why is this significant? Well, it's significant because the original audience, remember, where is Moses? Moses is in the plains of Moab with the children of Israel, and they're about to enter the Eretz. They're about to enter the land of Canaan, right? This is it's the same word that's used when you're talking about the Eretz that God is forming and the Eretz that they're about to enter. And the idea is that if God has the power to make something like the earth, which was formless and void, and make a garden possible, couldn't God take the Eretz of Canaan and prepare it for them? Right? God has power over the Eretz, over the land, to make it a land flowing of milk and honey for them. Right, so you see this use of the Eretz as a theme that gets developed throughout, and it starts in the Genesis 1 narrative. So you have this theme development. Again, one of the reasons why it's a masterpiece. You have most of the themes in the Old Testament deriving their Genesis, in Genesis, right? So you have this theme starting to develop. The other aspect that's really important to understand about Genesis is that it's a polemic against other ancient Near Eastern deities, right? It's a polemic against other ancient Near Eastern concepts of the divine, of how the world came about. It answers some of the questions or challenges some of the answers given by some of the other deities that are around them. And it does so by engaging with some of their myths, the themes of their myths that they use. So a really good example, Genesis 1 shows a distinct opposition to astral worship in the creation of the lesser and the greater lights, right? Astral worship is the worship of the luminaries, the sun, the moon, the stars, and so forth, right? When God creates the sun and the moon, right, it doesn't use the normal words in Hebrew for sun and moon. There are great words for sun and for moon, right? There are words that mean that, right? In for example, sun is Shemesh. It doesn't do that. It calls them the greater light and the lesser light, right? It's distinctly showing these are just greater lights. They're just lights. They're just there to serve a function. They're not there. They're not deities. They're not there to be worshipped. They aren't. If you read any other of their neighboring cosmogonies, right? These things were divine. They were deities, right? Shemesh actually became a name for a sun god in Palestine. And so by not saying that God created Shemesh, right, to kind of, you know, he didn't want to reinforce that there was this sun deity, right? The author calls them the greater light and the lesser light. They're not deities. They are created and they obey the will of God, right? They're created natural entities, just like everything else. There's no special significance to them. And so it gives a different concept of God as opposed to the gods of the other nations. Yahweh is viewed as the ultimate power with no rivals, right? They're unlike every other theogony, every other birth narrative of the gods, every other creation narrative, there is no waging of war among the gods to bring about creation, right? You don't have any of that going on. God simply creates by his free will. I'm going to take a minute. This might take a little bit of time. I'm going to actually read through a summary of one of the ancient Near Eastern creation myths, so you can kind of get a flavor of it. This is a Babylonian story. It's a creation story, and it comes largely from the Enuma Elish, and which appears sometime between 1900 and 1500 BC, so roughly during maybe the time of Abraham, a little bit before. Perhaps during the Babylonian king Hammurabi. The tablets of both are broken and they're incomplete. And at the end of the story, the details of the creation of humans are supplemented with material from some fragments of other writings. Right, the latter may date as late as the 500 BC BCE, but their consistency with the earlier Enuma Elish suggests that they tell the same story, really. And the main actor in the story of the tablets is Marduk. And Marduk is the most powerful of the Babylonian gods. Like most Babylonian gods, he has a ton of names, and sometimes he's also known as Bel, for example. So this is going to be, I'm going to read the short summary of how Marduk creates the earth. Okay. In the beginning, neither heaven nor earth had names. Apsu, the god of fresh waters, and Tiamat, the goddess of the salt oceans, and Mamu, the god of the mist that rises from both of them, were still mingled as one. There were no mountains, there was no pasture land, and not even a reed marsh could be found to break the surface of the waters. It was then that Apsu and Tiamat parented two gods, and then two more who outgrew the first pair. These further parented gods until Ea, who was the god of the rivers and was Tiamat and Apsu's great-grandson, was born. Ea was the cleverest of the gods, and with his magic, Ea became the most powerful of the gods, ruling even his forebears. Apsu and Tiamat's descendants became an unruly crowd. Eventually, Apsu, in his frustration and inability to sleep with the clamor, went to Tiamat. And he proposed to her that he slay their noisy offspring. Tiamat was furious at his suggestion to kill their clan, but after leaving her, Apsu resolved to proceed with his murderous plan. When the young gods heard of this plot against them, they were silent and fearful, but soon Ea was hatching a scheme. He cast a spell on Apsu and pulled Apsu's crown from his head and slew him. Ea then built his palace on Apsu's waters, and it was there that with the goddess Damkina, he fathered Marduk, the four-eared, four-eyed giant who was god of the rains and the storms. The other gods, however, went to Tiamat and complained of how Ea had slain her husband. Aroused, she collected an army of dragons and monsters, and at its head she placed the god Kingu, whom she gave magical powers as well. Even Ea was at a loss how to combat such a host until he finally called on his son Marduk. Marduk gladly agreed to take on his father's battle on the condition that he, Marduk, would rule the gods after achieving the victory. The other gods agreed, and at a banquet they gave him his royal robes and scepter. Marduk armed himself with a bow and arrows, a club, and lightning, and he went in search of Tiamat's monstrous army. Rolling his thunder and storms in front of him, he attacked, and Kingu's battle plan soon disintegrated. Tiamat was left alone to fight Marduk, and she howled as they closed for battle. They struggled as Marduk caught her in his nets. When he opened her mouth to devour him, he filled it with the evil wind that served him. She could not close her mouth with his gale blasting in it, and he shot an arrow down her throat. It split her heart, and she was slain. After subduing the rest of her hosts, he took his club and split Tiamat's water-laden body in half like a clamshell. Half he put in the sky and made the heavens, and he posted guards there to make sure that Tiamat's salt waters could not escape. Across the heavens he made stations in the stars for the gods, and he made the moon and set it forth on its schedule across the heavens. From the other half of Tiamat's body he made the land, which he placed over Apsu's fresh waters, which now arise in wells and springs. From her eyes he made flow the Tigris and the Euphrates. Across this land he made the grains and the herbs, the pastures and fields, the rains and the seas, the cows and the ewes, the forests and the orchards. Marduk set the vanquished gods who had supported Tiamat to a variety of tasks, including work in the fields and the canals. Soon they complained of their work, however, and they rebelled by burning their spades and baskets. Marduk saw a solution to their labors, though, and proposed it to Ea. He and Kingu, Tiamat's general, brought forward from the ranks of the defeated gods, and Kingu was slain. With Kingu's blood, with clay from the earth, and with spittle from the other gods, Ea and the birth goddess Nintu created humans. On them, Ea imposed the labor previously assigned to the gods. Thus, the humans were set to maintain the canals and the boundary ditches, to hoe and to carry, to irrigate the land and to raise crops, to raise animals and fill the granaries, and to worship the gods at their regular festivals. Right, so that's just a little taste of one of these other ancient Near Eastern myths. And so what we see, right, there is a little bit of borrowing happen. It's not actually a major thing. And there's so many people that are like, oh, the Bible borrows from these other myths, and they freak out, and they're like, oh, therefore it can't be an error, and it can't be God inspired, and it's just myth and all this kind of stuff. Well, when we realize what's happening, the author is intentionally taking these myths and he's doing what's called polemics. He's using their stories and their narratives, and he's saying, no, look, it's not Marduk. It's not this supernatural battle that happens that leads to the waters above and the waters below. It's not this supernatural killing and shredding of one god and scattering them about that brings about the heavens and the earth. And so they're all imbued with divine power and all these kinds of things. No, there's God. And God spoke everything into existence. God is the one that's all powerful. They're doing polemics against these other deities, right? Some other ones in Canaan, Baal fights against Yam. Right. By the way, it's people who say Baal, it's Baal. So when you hear me say that, that's what I'm talking about. It's not a different thing than Baal. It's just pronounced Baal. So Baal fights against Yam, the sea monster, and the battle that ensues brings about creation. And so what you have is this view. It's showing that God is the majestic one. God is the powerful. God is the sovereign Lord. There's no other deities. There's no cosmogony. There's no, you know, ultimate battle in the heavens that's raging and all this kind of thing. There's no other deities, right? There's no hints of pagan ideas in Genesis or any kind of rivalry, right? We see this also a little bit in Psalm 93. Psalm 93 talks about the seas. The seas is actually a poor translation. It probably talks about the floods. So if you want to go to that verse, it uses the floods. And the floods was actually a title used by pagans for their sea god in the ancient Near East. And here it's applied to God, right? The idea is that God has defeated these other deities. It's use of polemics. The idea is that God is God alone. There is no other God. God is the only God. We see that Yahweh is the God of justice versus gods who are unpredictable, right? Ancient Near Eastern deities didn't operate with a sense of fairness or justice. They operated, they were petty, they were vindictive, they were jealous, right? All this kind of stuff. You jealous in a bad way. You don't have all this kind of stuff happening in the Old Testament, right? God is not like just a really superhuman. He's not just like a big, powerful, toddling human. He is transcendent. He's transcendent. He's holy other. Another major difference is the role of humanity. Oh, I wanted to back up. So you can see this polemics if you're interested in this. There's a book by John Currid that's out called Against the Gods. It entirely deals with the polemics. You see other examples. It's very prominent in the Exodus cycle, especially in the 10 plagues. You see things, basically every single plague was an attack on one of the Egyptian concepts of one of the deities, or of their concept of Pharaoh as the ultimate god, the ultimate one who maintained what they called Ma'at. Ma'at was kind of like the Hebrew concept of shalom. It was overall peace and well-being and prosperity of the land. That was Pharaoh's job, was to maintain Ma'at. And the plagues radically undermined that, and it was showing that it's not actually Pharaoh who has the right over life and death, right? Because Pharaoh is saying, I have power over Israel. I can tell you when you can come and go. I have the right over your firstborn children, right? And God is basically humbling Pharaoh and saying, no, you're not the powerful one. You're not the one that maintains Ma'at. You're not the one that maintains order. You're not the one who maintains the crops and the fields and health. It's not your deities. It's Yahweh. Yahweh is the one that does all this. And one of the good examples is the serpent situation. The serpent was the symbol of Pharaoh, right? It's where he got his divine power. And so when Moses came and threw down the staff, it turned into a serpent and ate up the serpents of the staffs of the magicians. It was the idea that God is the powerful one, that Pharaoh was not. Every time it talks about God rescuing Israel with his strong right arm, that's actually an Egyptian saying, right? It was Pharaoh who upheld Ma'at, upheld the glory of Egypt with his strong right arm, with his strong right hand. But here we see that Yahweh is the one that has the strong right hand. Over and over and over again, polemics is all throughout these passages. It's just an assault on the religious structure of Egypt at the time. We see this again, going back to Genesis. The role of humanity is very, very different in Genesis 1 than, for example, what we read, right? What we read in the Marduk story, why were humans created? Well, they were created to basically be slaves and servants and butlers to the gods, right? The gods didn't want to work. They didn't want to work the crops. They didn't want to work the canals. And so they created humans as a slave labor force to do it for them. Worship at that time, if you went to a temple, you were going to feed the gods. I mean, there was literally a time, there's literally stories where it talks about the gods are actually starving. They're starving to death because the humans haven't brought their sacrifices. The idea is that at the temples is actually where humans fed the gods. The gods needed humans to do this work so that the gods could eat. You don't get that in Genesis. The role of humanity in Genesis was to have a loving fellowship with God. God walks peacefully among their people. He actually sets up the garden for them. He ministers to them. He supports them. He supplies for all of their needs. God doesn't need humanity to feed him in his temples. The temple, which in other ancient Near Eastern was to eat the sacrifices, in Israel it was for God to be among his people. It was for people to have access to God. It was a different idea. And what we see in Genesis 1, the Mesopotamian flood story, that's the one I was thinking, Epic of Gilgamesh, Utnapishtim offers a sacrifice to the gods, and the deities flock to the sacrifices because they're starving since there was no sacrifices during the flood, right? In the Epic of Gilgamesh, Utnapishtim is like the Noah character, and during the flood, there was no food, so the deities couldn't eat, and so the first thing he does is he offers a sacrifice, except in the Noah story, he offers a sacrifice to glorify God. In the story of the Epic of Gilgamesh, Utnapishtim offers a sacrifice to feed the gods because they were starving. And so that's why they grant Utnapishtim and his wife eternal life. It's not for righteousness, but it's because he fed them to keep them alive, right? So you see these this kind of going all the way through the Pentateuch, you see these polemics happening, even in the Noah story. The Noah story is a polemic against the Epic of Gilgamesh stories. Doesn't mean that it's not history. It's just the way that it's telling it. Some of the details it's borrowing from these other myths to show that it's that their world and life view is incorrect. So going back, we also see what is happening in Genesis is that the garden is a narrative of a temple text. A temple text is a text that lays out the temple. Now, if you read the text of Genesis 1 through 3, and then you read, say, Exodus, and the layout for the tabernacle, or later in Kings, the layout for the temple, what you see is this division of holiness, right? This segmentation of access to God. So in Genesis, you have the earth at large, and then you have the land, and then you have the garden within the land. And that mirrors in the tabernacle and the temple, the outer courts, and then the inner courts where the sacrifices were done, and then the Holy of Holies where God resided, right? Because in the garden, you have the earth at large, you have the land, and then the garden is where God met with his people. It's where God met with Adam and Eve. That's where God met with them. In the same way that you have the outer courts, the inner courts, and the Holy of Holies, which is where God's presence was, a special manifestation of God's presence. So again, it's polemics, right? So in the ancient Near East, the temples were where God used to go and rest and be fed, right? That's where they used to go sleep. It's where they used to go get a snack. They used to go eat. In the Bible, that's not the case. In the Bible, the garden is where God walks with his people to give us rest and to give us nourishment. In the Bible, in the tabernacle, and in the temple, it's where God comes to meet his people. It's where God dispenses atoning grace. It's where God accepts the sacrifices to atone for the people so that they can maintain the relationship with him. It's not so that he can be fed and he can sleep, right? The idea is that we rest on the seventh day. It gives us rest. We also see as part of the temple text that Adam is viewed as a priest. Adam is viewed as a priest. We're told that what's his job? His job is to tend and to keep. The verb to tend is the verb avad. The same word in Hebrew, which is frequently used for the spiritual service, specifically in serving the Lord, such as in Deuteronomy 4:19, and for the duties of the Levites in the tabernacle, right? So we see this in Numbers 3:7-8 and 4:23-26. So we're told that they were to avad. That was how they practiced their duties as priests and Levites. The other verb, to keep, is the Hebrew word shamar. Shamar, which is regularly used to denote kind of observing spiritual duties or keeping the commands of God. We see it in Leviticus 18:5 for keeping the commands of God. You keep, you tend to the Lord and you keep his commands. It's also used to describe the Levites who were charged in guarding the tabernacle from intruders, right? They were to protect it. We see it in Numbers 1:53 and Numbers 3:7-8. So Adam is seen as a priest. He is to avad and shamar. He is to do the role that the priests, that the Levites were to do. And whenever the two words are paired together in the Old Testament, within a 15-word range of each other, they always refer to either Israel serving God in a worshipful devotion or to the Levitical priesthood serving God through their consecrated duties in the temple. Always. It always refers to either worship or consecrated duties of the Levitical priesthood. And so Adam is seen as basically the archetypal priest. He is the first priest. We see in Numbers 3:7-8, it says, and they shall attend, they shall avad to his needs and the needs of the whole congregation before the tabernacle of meeting, to do the work, to shamar of the tabernacle. And they shall attend, they shall avad, to all the furnishings of the tabernacle of meeting and to the needs of the children of Israel, to do the work, to shamar, of the tabernacle, Right, we see it again in Ezekiel 44:1. Nevertheless, I will make them keep charge of the temple, to avad of the temple, for all its work, for all the shamar, and for all that has to be done in it, all that has to be shamarred, basically. So all in all, is it history? Right, when we're reading through Genesis, is it history? Is it literal? Is it metaphor? Is it allegory? Right? This is why the issue of hermeneutics was so important, and it's not an easy answer, because the answer is yes and no. It's likely a very polemicized and theologized history, and the view is clearly phenomenological in its perspective, right? It's a view from Earth. I mean, we still say this. We still say the sun rises and the sun sets. Do we actually mean the sun rises? Well, no, the Earth is rotating, but from our perspective, it looks like it's rising. That's a phenomenological perspective. So you have polemics, you have theologized history happening, and you have phenomenological perspective happening, right? So they really believe that God was creator and that he worked through a creative process. That's literal history. God created. However, because they're concerned with function, they're not concerned with chronology. That just wasn't a question that they would have asked in their worldview. That wasn't one of their interests. They were interested in the significance of the event. So for them, the most literal meaning would have been the significance of God as creator as opposed to other deities. That is the literal intent of the author that he's giving. Is there metaphor involved? Absolutely, there's metaphor involved. Are they describing real events? Did God really create and order the universe for these purposes? Yes. Is it done in that chronological order, in that time frame? No, it's doing it in a literary and polemical and theologized way. So is it literal? Is it history? Is it metaphor? Is it allegory? Yes to all of the above. And we see this. There's one last little feature of the narrative that I left this towards the end, and I'm only going to say a brief, super brief comment about it. There's a Hebrew literary device that's used whenever the author means a narrative to be viewed as history. It doesn't happen in poetry. It doesn't happen in proverb, right? You have this happening in narrative, right? You have what's called the imperfect vav construction in Hebrew. That is before you have verbs, the and then, or and this happened, and this happened, and this happened, and this happened. You have the imperfect vav before. So tohu va bo vohu, but you have it in the imperfect before one of the verbs, and that imperfect vav consecutive moves the narrative forward. It's always used in narrative, and so it's all throughout Genesis 1 and following. It's actually all throughout the Pentateuch, all throughout the historical literature. You have these vav consecutives, and then this happened, and then this happened, and it's moving the narrative plot line forward. And in Hebrew literature, this is an identifying mark of narrative, right? They didn't mean it as metaphorical poetry. They didn't mean it as allegorical prose. They meant it as a narrative, as a historical narrative. So that's the last little important thing. I'm going to put some books in the show notes about some of these different views on Genesis, so you can read those if you want to study up on some of these issues, if you would like. So that's all the time I have for you today. I know parting is such sweet, sweet sorrow. But as always, if you have any comments or questions, concerns, commendations, condemnations, or yes, even imprecations, then please contact me by visiting the blog at freedthinkerpodcast.blogspot.com, emailing freedthinkerpodcast@gmail.com, or join the Freed Thinker Podcast Facebook group. I recommend going there. That's probably the most oft-visited visited and posted in section. You get some really good discussions in there from some of the group. I also have a Twitter, which you can follow me on, which is @FreedPodcast. But I don't really use it that often. So I guess if there's enough of you who follow it and bother me about it, I might start being on there a bit more regularly. I use Hootsuite so it can post in a bunch of different places at the same time. So if you guys are looking there, let me know. I'll start posting there. I just don't have a ton of time right now since no one, you know, I think I have like 5 followers there. No one really knows I use Twitter. But if I get enough there, I'll start using it. So with that, thank you again for joining me. I really do appreciate all of your support and the discussions that follows. I look forward to more of this to come. And Thomas, thank you for having me on your show. I really do appreciate it. You now have the right to rejoinder. If you'd like to come on my show with any responses, or if you'd like, you know, I doubt you want to take up another podcast for this topic on your own. But if you want to come back on my show, you definitely have the open invitation to come on about this or any other topic you feel is relevant. But until then, thank you all, and keep on keeping on, and God bless. Good night, everybody.